A county clerk, I believe.
Tiens. But proceed, my lord.
Well, the Premier started for London. The car was a closed one. He and Captain Daniels sat inside. The second car followed as usual. But unluckily, for some unknown reason, the Prime Minister's car deviated from the main road.
At the point where the road curves?
Interrupted Poirot. Yes, but how did you know?
Ah, c'est évident. Continue.
For some unknown reason, continued Lord Astaire, the Premier's car left the main road. The police car, unaware of the deviation, continued to keep to the high road. At a short distance down the unfrequented lane, the Prime Minister's car was suddenly held up by a band of masked men. The chauffeur...
Ah, that brave O'Murphy, murmured Poirot thoughtfully.
The chauffeur, momentarily taken aback, jammed on the brakes. The Prime Minister put his head out of the window. Instantly a shot rang out, then another. The first one grazed his cheek, the second, fortunately, went wide. The chauffeur, now realizing the danger, instantly forged straight ahead, scattering the band of men.
"Phew! A near escape," I ejaculated with a shiver.
But Mr. McAdam refused to make any fuss over the slight wound he had received. He declared it was only a scratch. He stopped at a local cottage hospital where it was dressed and bound up. He did not, of course, reveal his identity. He then drove, as per schedule, straight to Charing Cross, where a special train for Dover was awaiting him. And, after a brief account of what had happened had been given to the anxious police by Captain Daniels, he duly departed for France. At Dover, he went on board the waiting destroyer. At Boulogne, as you know, the bogus car was waiting for him, carrying the Union Jack and correct in every detail.
Is that is all you have to tell me?
Yes.
There is no other circumstance that you have omitted, my lord?
Well, there is one rather peculiar thing.
Yes?
The Prime Minister's car did not return home after leaving the Prime Minister at Charing Cross. The police were anxious to interview O'Murphy, so a search was instituted at once. The car was discovered standing outside a certain unsavoury little restaurant in Soho, which is well known as a meeting place of German agents.
And the chauffeur?
The chauffeur was nowhere to be found. He, too, had disappeared.
So, said Poirot thoughtfully, there are two disappearances, the Prime Minister in France and O'Murphy in London.
He looked keenly at Lord Astaire, who made a gesture of despair. I can only tell you, Monsieur Poirot, that if anyone had suggested to me yesterday that O'Murphy was a traitor, I should have laughed in his face.
And today?
Well, today I do not know what to think. Poirot nodded gravely. He looked at his turnip of a watch again.
I understand that I have carte blanche, monsieur, in every way, I mean. I must be able to go where I choose and how I choose.
Oh, perfectly. There is a special train leaving for Dover in 1 hour's time, with a further contingent from Scotland Yard. You shall be accompanied by a military officer and a CID man who will hold themselves at your disposal in every way. Is that satisfactory?
Quite. One more question before you leave, monsieur. What made you come to me? I am, well, unknown, obscure in this great London of yours.
Well, we sought you out on the express recommendation and wish of a very great man of your own country.
Comment? My old friend, the préfet?
Lord Astaire shook his head. One higher than the préfet, one whose word was once law in Belgium and shall be again. That England has sworn. Poirot's hand flew swiftly to a dramatic salute.
Amen to that. But my master does not forget. Ah, monsieur, I, Hercule Poirot, will serve you faithfully. Heaven only send that it will be in time. But this is dark, dark. I cannot see.
Well, Poirot, I cried impatiently as the door closed behind the ministers, what do you think? My friend was busy packing a minute suitcase with quick, deft movements. He shook his head thoughtfully.
I don't know what to think. My brains desert me.
Well, why, as you said, kidnap him when a knock on the head would do as well, I mused.
Pardon me, mon ami, but I did not quite say that. It is undoubtedly far more their affair to kidnap him.
Oh, but why?
Because uncertainty creates panic. That is one reason. Were the Prime Minister dead, it would be a terrible calamity, but the situation would have to be faced. But now you have paralysis. Will the Prime Minister reappear or will he not? Is he dead or alive? Nobody knows. And until they know, nothing definite can be done. And as I tell you, uncertainty breeds panic, which is what les Boches are playing for. Then again, if the kidnappers are holding him secretly somewhere, they have the advantage of being able to make terms with both sides. The German government is not a liberal paymaster as a rule, but no doubt they can be made to disgorge substantial remittances in such a case as this. Thirdly, they run no risk of the hangman's rope. Oh, decidedly, kidnapping is their affair.
Well, then, if that is so, why should they first try to shoot him? Poirot made a gesture of anger.
Ah! That is just what I do not understand. It is inexplicable, stupid. They have all their arrangements made, and very good arrangements, too, for the abduction. And yet they imperil the whole affair by a melodramatic attack worthy of a cinema and quite as unreal. It is almost impossible to believe in it, with its band of masked men not 20 miles from London.
Or perhaps there were two quite separate attempts which happened irrespective of each other, I suggested.
Ah, no. That would be too much of a coincidence. Then, further, who is the traitor? There must have been a traitor in the first affair, anyway. But who was it? Daniels or O'Murphy? Well, it must have been one of the two, or why did the car leave the main road? We cannot suppose that the Prime Minister connived at his own assassination. Now, did O'Murphy take that turning of his own accord, or was it Daniels who told him to do so?
Well, surely it must have been O'Murphy's doing.
Yes, because if it was Daniels, the Prime Minister would have heard the order and would have asked the reason. But you know, there are altogether too many whys in this affair, and they contradict each other. If O'Murphy is an honest man, why did he leave the main road? But if it was a dishonest man, why did he start a car again when only 2 shots had been fired, thereby in all probability saving the Prime Minister's life? And again, if he was honest, why did he immediately on leaving Charing Cross drive to a well-known rendezvous of German spies?
God, it looks bad, I said.
Let us look at the case with method. What have we for and against these two men? Take O'Murphy first. Against. That his conduct in leaving the main road was suspicious. That he is an Irishman from County Clare. That he has disappeared in a highly suggestive manner. Yeah. Now, for. That his promptness in restarting the car saved the Premier's life. That he is a Scotland Yard man, and obviously, from the post allotted to him, a trusted detective. Now for Daniels. Well, there is not much against him, except the fact that nothing is known of his antecedents, and that he speaks too many languages for a good Englishman.
Pardon, mon ami, but as linguists, you are deplorable.
Now, for him, we have the fact that he was found gagged, bound, and chloroformed, which does not look as though he had anything to do with the matter.
Well, he might have gagged and bound himself to divert suspicion. Poirot shook his head.
No, the French police would make no mistake of that kind. Besides, once he had attained his object and the Prime Minister was safely abducted, there would not be much point in his remaining behind. His accomplices could have gagged and chloroformed him, of course, but I fail to see what object they hoped to accomplish by it. He can be of little use to them now, for until the circumstances concerning the Prime Minister have been cleared up, he is bound to be closely watched.
Well, perhaps he hoped to start the police on a false scent.
Then why did he not do so? He merely says that something was pressed over his nose and mouth and that he remembers nothing more. No, there is no false scent there. It sounds remarkably like the truth.
Well, I said, glancing at the clock, I suppose we'd better start for the station. You may find more clues in France.
Possibly, mon ami, but I doubt it. It is incredible to me that the Prime Minister has not been discovered in that limited area where the difficulty of concealing him must be tremendous. If the military and the police of two countries have not found him, how shall I?
At Charing Cross, we were met by Mr. Dodge.
Aye, now this is Detective Barnes of Scotland Yard and Major Norman. They will hold themselves entirely at your disposal. Now, good luck to you. It's a bad business, but I've not given up hope. Must be off now.
And the minister strode rapidly away. We chatted in a desultory fashion with Major Norman. In the centre of the little group of men on the platform, I recognised a little ferret-faced fellow talking to a tall, fair man. He was an old acquaintance of Poirot's, Detective Inspector Japp, supposed to be one of the smartest of Scotland Yard's officers. He came over and greeted my friend cheerfully.
I heard you were on this job too.
Smart bit of work. So far they've got away with the goods all right, but I can't believe they can keep him hidden long. Our people are going through France with a tooth comb, and so are the French. I can't help feeling it's only a matter of hours now.
Well, yes, that is, if he's still alive, remarked the tall detective gloomily. Japp's face fell.
Yes, but somehow I've got the feeling he's still alive all right.
Poirot nodded.
Oh, yes, yes, he's alive. But can he be found in time? I, like you, did not believe he could be hidden so long.
The whistle blew, and we all trooped up into the Pullman car. Then, with a slow, unwilling jerk, the train drew out of the station. It was a curious journey. The Scotland Yard men crowded together. Maps of northern France were spread out, and eager forefingers traced the lines of roads and villages. Each man had his own pet theory. Poirot showed none of his usual loquacity, but sat staring in front of him with an expression on his face that reminded me of a puzzled child. I talked to Norman, whom I found quite an amusing fellow. Well, on arriving at Dover, Poirot's behaviour moved me to intense amusement. The little man, as he went on board the boat, clutched desperately at my arm. The wind was blowing lustily.
Oh, mon Dieu, he murmured. This is terrible.
Oh, have courage, Poirot, I cried. You'll succeed. You'll find him, I'm sure of it.
Oh, mon ami, you mistake my emotion. It is this villainous sea that troubles me. The mal de mer, hein? It is horrible suffering.
Oh, I said, rather taken aback. The first throb of the engines was felt, and Poirot groaned and closed his eyes.
Look, Major Norman has a map of northern France, if you would like to study it.
Poirot shook his head impatiently.
No, leave me, my friend. See you to think, eh? The stomach and the brain must be in harmony. Lavergier has a method most excellent for averting the mal de mer. If you breathe in and out slowly, so, in turning the head from left to right and counting six between each breath,
I left him to his gymnastic endeavours and went on deck. As we came slowly into Boulogne Harbour, Poirot appeared, neat and smiling, and announced to me in a whisper that Lavergier's system had succeeded to a marvel. Japp's forefinger was still tracing imaginary routes on his map.
Nonsense. The car started from Boulogne. Here they branched off. Now, my idea is that they transferred the Prime Minister to another car. See?
Well, said the tall detective, I shall make for the seaports. 10 to 1 they've smuggled him on board a ship.
Japp shook his head. No. Too obvious. The order went out at once to close all the ports. The day was just breaking as we landed. Major Norman touched Poirot on the arm.
Oh, there's a military car here waiting for you, sir.
Ah, thank you, monsieur, but for the moment I do not propose to leave Boulogne.
What?
No, we will enter this hotel here by the quay.
He suited the action to the word, demanded and was accorded a private room. We three followed him, puzzled and uncomprehending. He shot a quick glance at us.
Ah, it is not so that a good detective should act, eh? I perceive your thought. He must be full of energy, eh? He must rush to and fro, eh? He should prostrate himself on the dusty road and seek the marks of tires through a little glass, eh? He must gather up the cigarette end, the fallen match, eh? That is your idea, is it not?
His eyes challenged us.
But I, Hercule Poirot tell you that it is not so. The true clues are within here.
He tapped his forehead. See you? I need not have left London. It would have been sufficient for me to sit quietly in my rooms there. All that matters is the little grey cells within. Secretly and silently they do their part, until suddenly I call for a map and lay my finger on a spot, so. And I say, the Prime Minister is there. And it is so. With method and logic one can accomplish anything. This frantic rushing to France was a mistake. It is playing a child's game of hide-and-seek. But now, though it may be too late, I will set to work the right way from within. Silence, my friends, I beg of you.
And for 5 long hours, the little man sat motionless, blinking his eyelids like a cat, his green eyes flickering and becoming steadily greener and greener. The Scotland Yard man was obviously contemptuous. Major Norman was bored and impatient, and I myself found the time pass with wearisome slowness. Finally, I got up and strolled as noiselessly as I could to the window. The matter was becoming a farce. I was secretly concerned for my friend. If he failed, I would have preferred him to fail in a less ridiculous manner. Out of the window, I idly watched the Daily leave boat, belching forth columns of smoke as she lay alongside the quay. Suddenly I was aroused by Poirot's voice close to my elbow.
Mes amis, let us start.
I turned. An extraordinary transformation had come over my friend. His eyes were flickering with excitement. His chest was swelled to the uttermost.
I have been an imbecile, my friends, but I see daylight at last.
Major Norman moved hastily to the door.
Well, I'll order the car.
No, there is no need. I shall not use it. Thank heaven the wind has fallen.
Well, do you mean you're going to walk, sir?
No, my young friend, I am no St. Peter. I prefer to cross the sea by boat.
But across the sea?
Yes. To work with method, one must begin from the beginning, and the beginning of this affair was in England. Therefore, we return to England.
At 3 o'clock, we stood once more upon Charing Cross platform. To all our expostulations, Poirot turned a deaf ear, and reiterated again and again that to start at the beginning was not a waste of time, but the only way. On the way over, he had conferred with Norman in a low voice, and the latter had dispatched a sheaf of telegrams from Dover. Owing to the special passes held by Norman, we got through everywhere in record time. In London, a large police car was awaiting for us with some plainclothes men, one of whom handed a typewritten sheet of paper to my friend. He answered my inquiring glance.
A list of the cottage hospitals with a certain radius west of London. I wired for it from Dover.
We were whirled rapidly through the London streets. We were on the Bath Road. On we went through Hammersmith, Chiswick, and Brentford. I began to see our objective, through Windsor and so on to Ascot. My heart gave a leap. Ascot was where Daniels had an aunt living. We were after him, then, not O'Murphy. We duly stopped at the gate of a trim villa. Poirot jumped out and rang the bell. I saw a perplexed frown dimming the radiance of his face. Plainly, he was not satisfied. The bell was answered. He was ushered inside. In a few moments he reappeared and climbed into the car with a short, sharp shake of his head. My hopes began to die down. It was past 4 now. Even if he found certain evidence incriminating Daniels, what would be the good of it, unless he could wring from someone the exact spot in France where they were holding the Prime Minister? Our return progress towards London was an interrupted one. We deviated from the main road more than once, and occasionally stopped at a small building, which I had no difficulty in recognising as a cottage hospital. Poirot only spent a few minutes at each, but at every halt his radiant assurance was more and more restored. He whispered something to Norman, to which the latter replied,
Yes, if you turn off to the left, you'll find them waiting by the bridge.
We turned up a side road, and in the failing light I discerned a second car, waiting by the side of the road. It contained 2 men in plain clothes. Poirot got down and spoke to them, and then we started off in a northerly direction, the other car following close behind. We drove for some time, our objective being obviously one of the northern suburbs of London. Finally, we drove up to the front door of a tall house standing a little back from the road in its own grounds.
Norman and I were left with the car. Poirot and one of the detectives went up to the door and rang. A neat parlourmaid opened it. The detective spoke. "I'm a police officer, and I have a warrant to search this house." The girl gave a little scream, and a tall, handsome woman of middle age appeared behind her in the hall. "Shut the door, Edith! They're burglars, I expect." But Poirot swiftly inserted his foot in the door, and at the same time blew a whistle. Instantly, the other detectives ran up and poured into the house, shutting the door behind them. Norman and I spent about 5 minutes cursing our forced inactivity. Finally, the door reopened, and the men emerged, escorting three prisoners, a woman and two men. The woman and one of the men were taken to the second car. The other man was placed in our car by Poirot himself.
"I must go with the others, my friend, but have great care of this gentleman. You do not know him, no? Eh bien, let me present to you Monsieur Murphy."
"Oh, Murphy!"
I gaped at him open-mouthed as we started again. He was not handcuffed, but I did not fancy he would try to escape. He sat there staring in front of him as though dazed. Anyway, Norman and I would be more than a match for him. To my surprise, we still kept a northerly route. We were not returning to London then. I was much puzzled. Suddenly, as the car slowed down, I recognised that we were close to Hendon Aerodrome. Immediately I grasped Poirot's idea. He proposed to reach France by aeroplane. Oh, it was a sporting idea, but on the face of it, impracticable. A telegram would be far quicker. Time was everything. He must leave the personal glory of rescuing the Prime Minister to others. As we drew up, Major Norman jumped out, and a plainclothes man took his place. He conferred with Poirot for a few minutes and then went off briskly. I, too, jumped out and caught Poirot by the arm. "I congratulate you, old fellow. They've told you the hiding place? But look here, you must wire to France at once. You'll be too late if you go yourself." Poirot looked at me curiously for a minute or two.
"Unfortunately, my friend, there are some things that cannot be sent by telegram."
At that moment, Major Norman returned, accompanied by a young officer in the uniform of the Flying Corps.
This is Captain Lyle, who will fly you over to France. He can start at once."
"I'll wrap up warmly, sir," said the young pilot. "I can lend you a coat, if you like."
Poirot was consulting his enormous watch. He murmured to himself,
"Yes, there is time, just time."
Then he looked up and bowed politely to the young officer.
"I thank you, monsieur, but it is not I who am your passenger. It is this gentleman here."
He moved a little aside as he spoke, and a figure came forward out of the darkness. It was the second male prisoner who had gone in the other car, and as the light fell on his face, I gave a start of surprise. It was the Prime Minister. "For heaven's sake, tell me all about it," I cried impatiently, as Poirot, Norman and I motored back to London. "How in the world did they manage to smuggle him back to England?"
"There was no need to smuggle him back," replied Poirot dryly. "The Prime Minister has never left England. He was kidnapped on his way from Windsor to London."
"What?"
"I will make all clear. The Prime Minister was in his car, his secretary beside him. Suddenly a pad of chloroform is clapped on his face."
But by whom?"
"By the clever linguistic Captain Daniels. As soon as the Prime Minister is unconscious, Daniels picks up the speaking tube and directs O'Murphy to turn to the right, which the chauffeur, quite unsuspicious, does. A few yards down that unfrequented road, a large car is standing, apparently broken down. Each driver signals to O'Murphy to stop. O'Murphy slows up. The stranger approaches. Daniels leans out of the window and, probably with the aid of an instantaneous anesthetic, such as ethyl chloride, the chloroform trick is repeated. In a few seconds, the two helpless men are dragged out and transferred to the other car. A pair of substitutes take their places."
"Impossible!"
"Pas du tout. Have you not seen musical turns imitating celebrities with marvelous accuracy? Nothing is easier than to personate a public character. The Prime Minister of England is far easier to understudy than Mr. John Smith of Clapham, say. As for O'Murphy's double, no one was going to take much notice of him until after the departure of the Prime Minister, and by then he would have made himself scarce. he drives straight from Charing Cross to the meeting place of his friends. He goes in as O'Murphy, and he emerges as someone quite different. O'Murphy has disappeared, leaving a conveniently suspicious trail behind him.
But the man who personated the Prime Minister was seen by everyone.
He was not seen by anyone who knew him privately or intimately, and Daniels shielded him from contact with anyone as much as possible. Moreover, his face was bandaged up, and anything unusual in his manner would be put down to the fact that he was suffering from shock as a result of the attempt upon his life. Mr. McAdam has a weak throat and always spares his voice as much as possible before any great speech. The deception was perfectly easy to keep up as far as France, but there it would be impractical and impossible. So the Prime Minister disappears. The police of this country hurry across the Channel, and no one bothers to go into the details of the first attack. To sustain the illusion that the abduction has taken place in France, Daniels is gagged and chloroformed in a convincing manner.
And the man who has enacted the part of the Prime Minister
rids himself of his disguise. He and the bogus chauffeur may be arrested as suspicious characters, but no one will dream of suspecting their real part in the drama, and they will eventually be released for lack of evidence.
And the real Prime Minister?
He and O'Murphy were driven straight to the house of Mrs. Everard at Hampstead, Daniel's so-called aunt. In reality, she is Frau Bertha Ebenthal, and the police have been looking for her for some time. It is a valuable little present that I have made them, to say nothing of Daniel's.
Ah, it was a clever plan, but he did not reckon on the cleverness of Hercule Poirot.
I think my friend might well be excused his moment of vanity. When did you first begin to suspect the truth of the matter?
When I began to work the right way, from within. I could not make that shooting affair fit in. But when I saw that the net result of it was that the Prime Minister went to France with his face bound up, I began to comprehend. And when I visited all the cottage hospitals between Windsor and London, I found that no one answering to my description had had his face bound up and dressed that morning. I was sure. After that, it was child's play for a mind like mine.
The following morning, Poirot showed me a telegram he had just received. It had no place of origin and was unsigned. It ran, "In time." Later in the day, the evening papers published an account of the Allied conference. They laid particular stress on the magnificent ovation accorded to Mr. David McAdam, whose inspiring speech had produced a deep and lasting impression.
The disappearance of Mr. Davenheim. Poirot and I were expecting our old friend Inspector Japp of Scotland Yard to tea. We were sitting round the tea table awaiting his arrival. Poirot had just finished carefully straightening the cups and saucers which our landlady was in the habit of throwing rather than placing on the table. He had also breathed heavily on the metal teapot and polished it with a silk handkerchief. The kettle was on the boil, and a small enamel saucepan beside it contained some thick, sweet chocolate, which was more to Poirot's palate than what he described as your English poison. A sharp rat-tat sounded below, and a few minutes afterwards Japp entered briskly. "Hope I'm not late," he said as he greeted us. "To tell the truth, I was yarning with Miller, the man who's in charge of the Davenheim case." I pricked up my ears. For the last 3 days the papers had been full of the strange disappearance of Mr. Davenheim, senior partner of Davenheim and Salmon, the well-known bankers and financiers. On Saturday last he had walked out of his house and had never been seen since. I looked forward to extracting some interesting details from Japp. "Look, I should have thought," I remarked, "that it would be almost impossible for anyone to disappear nowadays." Poirot moved a plate of bread and butter, the eighth of an inch, and said sharply,
"Be exact, my friend. What do you mean by disappear? To which class of disappearance are you referring?"
"Are disappearances classified and labelled, then?" I laughed.
Japp smiled also. Poirot frowned at both of us.
"But certainly they are. They fall into three categories. First, and most common, the voluntary disappearance. Second, the much-abused loss of memory case, rare but occasionally genuine. Third, murder, and a more or less successful disposal of the body. Do you refer to all three as impossible of execution?
Well, very nearly so, I should think.
You might lose your own memory, but someone would be sure to recognize you, especially in the case of a well-known man like Davenheim.
Then bodies can't be made to vanish into thin air. Sooner or later they turn up concealed in lonely places or in trunks.
Murder will out.
In the same way, the absconding clerk or the domestic defaulter is bound to be run down in these days of wireless telegraphy. He can be headed off from foreign countries, ports and railway stations are watched, and as for concealment in this country, his features and appearance will be known to everyone who reads a daily newspaper. He's up against civilization.
Ah, mon ami, said Poirot, you make one error. You do not allow for the fact that a man who had decided to make away with another man, or with himself in a figurative sense, might be that rare machine, eh? A man of method. He might bring intelligence, talent, a careful calculation of detail to the task. And then I do not see why he should not be successful in baffling the police force.
But not you, I suppose, said Jap good-humouredly, winking at me. He couldn't baffle you, eh, Monsieur Poirot? Poirot endeavoured, with a marked lack of success, to look modest.
Me? Also, why not? It is true that I approach such problems with an exact science, a mathematical precision, which seems, alas, only too rare in the new generation of detectives.
Jap grinned more widely.
Oh, I don't know, he said. Miller, the man who's on this case, is a smart chap. You may be very sure he won't overlook a footprint or a cigar ash or a crumb, even. He's got eyes that see everything.
So, mon ami, said Poirot,
has the London Sparrow. But, all the same, I should not ask the little brown bird to solve the problem of Mr. Davenheim. Come now, monsieur. You're not going to run down the value of details as clues?
Oh, by no means.
These things are all good in their way. The danger is they may assume undue importance. Most details are insignificant. One or two are vital. It is the brain, the little grey cells, he tapped his forehead, on which one must rely. The senses mislead. One must seek the truth within, not without.
Now, you don't mean to say, Monsieur Poirot, that you would undertake to solve a case without moving from your chair, do you?
That is exactly what I do mean. Granted the facts were placed before me, I regard myself as a consulting specialist.
Jap slapped his knee. Well, hanged if I don't take you at your word. Bet you a fiver you can't lay a hand, or rather tell me, where to lay my hand on Mr. Davenheim, dead or alive, before a week is out.
Poirot considered. Eh bien, mon ami, I accept. Le sport, it is the passion of you English. Now, the facts.
Well, on Saturday last, as is his usual custom, Mr. Davenheim took the 12:40 train from Victoria to Chingside, where his palatial country seat, the Cedars, is situated. After lunch, he strolled round the grounds and gave various directions to the gardeners. Now, everybody agrees that his manner was absolutely normal and as usual.
After tea, he put his head into his wife's boudoir, saying that he was going to stroll down to the village and post some letters. He added that he was expecting a Mr. Lowen on business. If he should come before he himself returned, he was to be shown into the study and asked to wait. Mr. Davenheim then left the house by the front door, passed leisurely down the drive and out at the gate, and was never seen again. From that hour, he vanished completely.
Pretty, huh? Very pretty. Altogether, a charming little problem, murmured Poirot.
Proceed, my good friend.
About a quarter of an hour later, a tall, dark man with a thick black moustache rang the front doorbell and explained that he had an appointment with Mr. Davenheim. He gave the name of Lowen and, in accordance with the banker's instructions, was shown into the study. Nearly an hour passed. Mr. Davenheim did not return. Finally, Mr. Lowen rang the bell and explained that he was unable to wait any longer, as he must catch his train back to town. Mrs. Davenheim apologized for her husband's absence, which seemed unaccountable, as she knew him to have been expecting the visitor. Mr. Lowen reiterated his regrets and took his departure. Well, as everyone knows, Mr. Davenheim did not return. Early on Sunday morning, the police were communicated with, but could make neither head nor tail of the matter. Mr. Davenheim seemed literally to have vanished into thin air. He had not been to the post office, nor had he been seen passing through the village. At the station, they were positive he had not departed by any train. His own motor had not left the garage. If he had hired a car to meet him in some lonely spot, it seems almost certain that by this time, in view of the large reward offered for information, the driver of it would have come forward to tell what he knew. Not true, there was a small race meeting at Entfield, 5 miles away, and if he had walked to that station, he might have passed unnoticed in the crowd, but since then his photograph and a full description of him have been circulated in every newspaper, and nobody's been able to give any news of him. Now, we have, of course, received many letters from all over England, but each clue, so far, has ended in disappointment. On Monday morning, a further sensational discovery came to light. Behind a portiere in Mr. Davenheim's study stands a safe, and that safe had been broken into and rifled. The windows were fastened securely on the inside, which seems to put an ordinary burglary out of court, unless, of course, an accomplice within the house fastened them again afterwards. On the other hand, Sunday having intervened and the household being in a state of chaos, it's likely that the burglary was committed on the Saturday and remained undetected until Monday. "Ah, precisément," said Poirot dryly. "Well, is he arrested, ce pauvre Monsieur Lowen?" Jap grinned. "Not yet, but he's under pretty close supervision." Poirot nodded. "What was taken from the safe? Have you any idea?" "We've been going into that with the junior partner of the firm and Mrs. Davenheim. Apparently there was a considerable amount in bearer bonds and a very large sum in notes, owing to some large transaction having been just carried through. There was also a small fortune in jewellery. All Mrs. Davenheim's jewels were kept in the safe. The purchasing of them had been a passion with her husband of late years, and hardly a month passed that he didn't make her a present of some rare and costly gem." "Altogether a good haul," said Poirot thoughtfully. "Now, what about Lowen? Is it known what his business was with Davenheim that evening?" "Well, the two men were apparently not on very good terms. Lowen is a speculator in quite a small way. Nevertheless, he's been able once or twice to score a coup off Davenheim in the market. Well, though it seems they seldom or never actually met. It was a matter concerning some South American shares which led the banker to make his appointment." "Had Davenheim interests in South America, then?" "I believe so. Mrs. Davenheim happened to mention that he spent all last autumn in Buenos Aires." "Any trouble in his home life? Well, I mean, was the husband and wife on good terms?" "Well, I should say his domestic life was quite peaceful and uneventful. Mrs. Davenheim is a pleasant, rather unintelligent woman. Well, quite a nonentity, I think." "Oh, then we must not look for the solution of the mystery there. Had he any enemies?" "Well, he had plenty of financial rivals, and no doubt there are many people, whom he has got the better of, who bear him no particular goodwill. But there was no one likely to make away with him. And if they had, well, where's his body?"
"Exactly. As Hastings says, bodies have a habit of coming to light with fatal persistency."
"Oh, and by the way, one of the gardeners says he saw a figure going around to the side of the house towards the rose garden. The long French window of the study opens onto the rose garden, and Mr. Davenheim frequently entered and left the house that way. But the gardener was a good way off, at work on some cucumber frames, and cannot even say whether it was the figure of his master or not. Also, he cannot fix the time with any accuracy. It must have been before 6, as the gardeners ceased to work at that time."
"And Mr. Davenheim left the house?"
"Oh, about 5:30 or thereabouts."
"Oh.
What lies beyond the rose garden?"
a lake, with a boathouse? Yes, a couple of punts are kept there. I suppose you're thinking of suicide, Monsieur Poirot, eh? Well, I don't mind telling you that Miller's going down tomorrow expressly to see that piece of water dragged. Well, that's the kind of man he is.
Poirot smiled faintly and turned to me.
Hastings, I pray you, hand me that copy of Daily Megaphone. If I remember rightly, there is an unusually clear photograph there of the missing man.
I rose and found the sheet required, and Poirot studied the features attentively.
"Hmm," he murmured. "Wears his hair rather long and wavy, full moustache and pointed beard, and bushy eyebrows. Eyes dark?
Yes.
Hair and beard turning grey?"
The detective nodded. "Well, Monsieur Poirot, what have you got to say to it all, then? Clear as daylight, eh?"
"On the contrary, most obscure."
The Scotland Yard man looked pleased.
"Which gives me great hopes of solving it," finished Poirot placidly.
"Eh?"
"No, I find it a good sign when the case is obscure. If a thing is clear as daylight, eh bien, mistrust it. Someone has made it so."
Chap shook his head almost pityingly. "Well, each to their fancy, but it's not a bad thing to see your way clear ahead."
"I do not see," murmured Poirot. "I shut my eyes and think."
Chap sighed. "Well, you've got a clear week to think in."
"And you'll bring me any fresh developments that arise, eh? The results of the labours of the hard-working and lynx-eyed Inspector Miller, for instance?"
"Oh, certainly. That's in the bargain."
"Seems a shame, doesn't it?"
said Jap to me as I accompanied him to the door. "It's like robbing a child." I could not help agreeing with a smile. I was still smiling as I re-entered the room.
"Eh bien," said Poirot immediately, "you make fun of Papa Poirot. Is it not so?"
He shook his finger at me.
"You do not trust his grey cells, eh? Do not be confused. Let us discuss this little problem, incomplete as yet, I admit, but already showing one or two points of interest."
"The lake," I said significantly.
"And even more than the lake, the boathouse."
I looked sideways at Poirot. He was smiling in his most inscrutable fashion. I felt that for the moment it would be quite useless to question him further. We heard nothing of Jap until the following evening, when he walked in at about 9 o'clock. I saw at once by his expression that he was bursting with news of some kind.
"Eh bien, my friend," remarked Poirot, "all goes well. But do not tell me that you have discovered the body of Mr. Davenheim in your lake, because I shall not believe you."
No, we haven't found the body, but we did find his clothes. The identical clothes he was wearing that day.
What do you say to that?" "Any other clothes missing from the house?"
"No. His valet was quite positive on that point. The rest of his wardrobe is intact. But there's more. We've arrested Lowen. One of the maids whose business it is to fasten the bedroom windows declares that she saw Lowen coming towards the study through the rose garden about 6:15. That would be about 10 minutes before he left the house."
"And what does he himself say to that?"
"Denied, first of all, that he'd ever left the study. But the maid was positive. And he pretended afterwards that he'd forgotten just stepping out of the window to examine an unusual species of rose."
"It's rather a weak story, hmm?"
"And there's fresh evidence against him has come to light. Mr. Davenheim always wore a thick gold ring, set with a solitaire diamond on the little finger of his right hand. Well, that ring was pawned in London on Saturday night by a man called Billy Kellett. Now, he's already known to the police, did 3 months last autumn for lifting an old gentleman's watch. Now, it seems he tried to pawn the ring at no less than 5 different places. Succeeded at the last one, got gloriously drunk on the proceeds, assaulted a policeman, and was run in consequence. I went to Bow Street with Miller and saw him. He's sober enough now, and I don't mind admitting we pretty well frightened the life out of him, hinting he might be charged with murder. Well, this is his yarn, and a very queer one it is. He was at Entfield Races on Saturday. Though I dare say scarf pins was his line of business rather than betting. Anyway, he had a bad day and was down on his luck. He was tramping along the road to Chingside and sat down in a ditch to rest just before he got into the village. A few minutes later, he noticed a man coming along the road to the village. Dark complexion gent, with a big moustache. One of them city toffs, is his description of the man. Kellett was half concealed from the road by a heap of stones. And just before he got abreast of him, the man looked quickly up and down the road, and seeing it apparently deserted, he took a small object from his pocket and threw it over the hedge. Then he went on towards the station. Now, the object he'd thrown over the hedge had fallen with a slight chink, which aroused the curiosity of the human derelict in the ditch. He investigated and, after a short search, discovered the ring. Well, that's Kellett's story. Now, it's only fair to say that Lowen denies it utterly, and of course the word of a man like Kellett can't be relied upon in the slightest. It's within the bounds of possibility that he met Davenheim in the lane and robbed and murdered him. Poirot shook his head.
Very improbable, mon ami. He had no means of disposing of the body. It would have been found by now. Secondly, the open way in which he pawned the ring makes it unlikely that he did murder to get it. Thirdly, your sneak thief is rarely a murderer. Fourthly, as he has been in prison since Saturday, it would be too much of a coincidence that he is able to give so accurate a description of Lowen.
Jap nodded. Well, I don't say you're not right, but all the same, you won't get a jury to take much note of a jailbird's evidence. What seems odd to me is that Lowen couldn't find a cleverer way of disposing of the ring.
Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
Well, after all, if it were found in the neighbourhood, it might be argued that Davenheim himself had dropped it.
Yes, but why remove it from the body at all? I cried.
Well, there might be a reason for that, said Jap.
Do you know that just beyond the lake a little gate leads out onto the hill, and not 3 minutes' walk brings you to, what do you think, eh? A lime kiln.
Good heavens, I cried.
You mean that the lime which destroyed the body would be powerless to affect the metal of the ring?
Exactly.
Well, it seems to me, I said, that explains everything. What a horrible crime.
By common consent, we both turned and looked at Poirot.
He seemed lost in reflection, his brow knitted, as though with some supreme mental effort. I felt at last his keen intellect was asserting itself. What would his first words be?
We were not long left in doubt. With a sigh, the tension of his attitude relaxed, and turning to Jap, he asked,
"Have you any idea, my friend, whether Mr. and Mrs. Davenheim occupy the same bedroom?"
But the question seemed so ludicrously inappropriate that for a moment we both stared in silence. Then Jap burst into a laugh.
"Oh, good Lord, Monsieur Poirot, I thought you were coming out with something startling. As to your question, well, I'm sure I don't know."
"You could find out?"
asked Poirot with curious persistence.
Well, certainly, if you really want to know."
"Merci, mon ami. I should be obliged if you would make a point of it."
Jap stared at him a few minutes longer, but Poirot seemed to have forgotten us both. The detective shook his head sadly at me and, murmuring, "Poor old fellow, war's been too much for him," gently withdrew from the room. As Poirot seemed sunk in a daydream, I took a sheet of paper and amused myself by scribbling notes upon it. My friend's voice aroused me. He had come out of his reverie and was looking brisk and alert.
"Que faites-vous là, mon ami?"
"I was jotting down what occurred to me as the main points of interest in this affair."
"Ah, you become methodical at last," said Poirot approvingly.
I concealed my pleasure.
"Shall I read them to you?"
"Oh, by all means." I cleared my throat. 1. All the evidence points to Lowen having been the man who forced the safe. 2. He had a grudge against Davenheim. 3. He lied in his first statement that he had never left the study. 4. If you accept Billy Kellett's story as true, Lowen is unmistakably implicated. I paused.
"Well?"
I asked, for I felt that I'd put my finger on all the vital facts. Poirot looked at me pityingly, shaking his head very gently.
"Oh, mon pauvre ami, but it is that you have not a gift. The important detail, you appreciate him never. Also, your reasoning is false."
"Well, how?"
"Let me take your 4 points. 1. Mr. Lowen could not possibly know that he would have the chance to open the safe. He came for a business interview.
He could not know beforehand that Mr. Davenheim would be absent, posting a letter, and that he would consequently be alone in the study.
Well, he might have seized the opportunity, I suggested.
And the tools? City gentlemen do not carry around housebreakers' tools on the off chance.
And one could not cut into that safe with a penknife.
Well, what about number two?
You say Lowen had a grudge against Mr. Davenheim. What you mean is that he had once or twice got the better of him, and presumably these transactions were entered into with a view of benefiting himself. In any case, you do not, as a rule, bear a grudge against a man you have got the better of. It is more likely to be the other way about. Whatever grudge there might have been would have been on Mr. Davenheim's side.
Well, you can't deny that he lied about never having left the study.
No. But he may have been frightened. Remember, the missing man's clothes had just been discovered in the lake. Of course, as usual, he would have done better to speak the truth.
And the fourth point?
No, I grant you that. If Kellett's story is true, Lowen is undeniably implicated. That is what makes the affair so very interesting.
Well, then I did appreciate one vital fact.
Perhaps, but you have entirely overlooked the two most important points, the ones which undoubtedly hold the clue to the whole matter.
And pray, what are they?
One. The passion which has grown upon Mr. Davenheim in the last few years for buying jewelry. Two, his trip to Buenos Aires last autumn.
Poirot, you are joking.
No, I am serious. Ah, sacred thunder, but I hope Jap will not forget my little commission.
But the detective, entering into the spirit of the joke, had remembered it so well that a telegram was handed to Poirot about 11 o'clock the next day. At his request, I opened it and read it out. Husband and wife have occupied separate rooms since last winter.
Aha! Cried Poirot. And now we are in mid-June. All is solved.
I stared at him.
You have no monies in the bank of Davenheim and Salmon, mon ami?
No, I said, wondering. Why?
Because I should advise you to withdraw it before it is too late.
Well, why? What do you expect?
I expect a big smash in a few days, perhaps sooner. Oh, which reminds me, we will return the compliment of a depeche to Jap. A pencil, I pray you, and a form. Voila. Advise you to withdraw any money deposited with firm in question.
Ah. That will intrigue him, the good Jap, eh?
His eyes will open wide, wide. He will not comprehend in the slightest until tomorrow or the next day.
I remained sceptical, but the morrow forced me to render tribute to my friend's remarkable powers. In every paper was a huge headline telling of the sensational failure of the Davenheim Bank. The disappearance of the famous financier took on a totally different aspect in the light of the revelation of the financial affairs of the bank. Before we were halfway through breakfast, the door flew open and Jap rushed in. In his left hand was a paper. In his right was Poirot's telegram, which he banged down on the table in front of my friend.
How did you know, Monsieur Poirot?
How the blazes could you know?
Poirot smiled placidly at him.
Ah, mon ami, after your wire, it was a certainty. From the commencement, see you, it struck me that the safe burglary was somewhat remarkable. Jewels, ready money, bearer bonds, all so conveniently arranged for whom? Well, the good Monsieur Davenheim was of those who look after number one, as your saying goes. It seemed almost certain that it was arranged for himself. And then his passion of late years for buying jewelry, huh? How simple! The funds he embezzled, he converted into jewels, very likely replacing them in turn with paste duplicates, and so he put away in a safe place under another name a considerable fortune to be enjoyed all in good time when everyone has been thrown off the track. His arrangements completed, he makes an appointment with Mr. Lowen, who has been imprudent enough in the past to cross the great man once or twice. He drills a hole in the safe, leaves orders that the guest is to be shown into the study, and walks out of the house. Where?
Poirot stopped and stretched out his hand for another boiled egg. He frowned.
"It is really insupportable," he murmured, "that every hen lays an egg of a different size. What symmetry can there be on the breakfast table? Huh? At least they should sort them in dozens at the shop."
"No, never mind the eggs," said Jap impatiently. "Let them lay them square if they like. Tell us where our customer went to when he left the Cedars. That is, if you know."
"Eh bien, he went to his hiding place. Ah, this Monsieur Davenheim. There may be some malformation in his gray cells, but they are of the first quality."
"Well, do you know where he's hiding?"
"Oh, certainly. It is most ingenious."
"Well, for the Lord's sake, tell us then."
Poirot gently collected every fragment of shell from his plate, placed them in the egg cup, and reversed the empty eggshell on top of them. This little operation concluded, he smiled on the neat effect and then beamed affectionately on both of us.
"Oh, come, my friends, you are men of intelligence. Ask yourselves the question I asked myself. If I were this man, where should I hide? Hastings, what do you say?"
"Well," I said, "I am rather inclined to think I'd not do a bolt at all. I'd stay in London, in the heart of things, travel by tubes and buses. 10 to 1 I'd never be recognised. Oh, there's safety in a crowd."
Poirot turned inquiringly to Jap.
No, I don't agree. Now get clear away at once. That's the only chance."
"I would have had plenty of time to prepare things beforehand. I'd have a yacht waiting with steam up, and I'd be off to one of the most out-of-the-way corners of the world before the hue and cry began."
We both looked at Poirot.
"What do you say, monsieur?"
For a moment he remained silent. Then a very curious smile flitted across his face.
"My friends, if I were hiding from the police, do you know where I should hide?"
"In a prison."
"What?"
"You are seeking Monsieur Davenheim in order to put him in prison. So you never dream of looking to see if he may not be already there."
"Well, what do you mean?"
"You tell me Madame Davenheim is not a very intelligent woman. Nevertheless, I think if you took her up to Bow Street and confronted her with a man, Billy Kellett, she would recognize him, in spite of the fact that he has shaved his beard and moustache and those bushy eyebrows, and has cropped his hair close. A woman nearly always knows her husband, so the rest of the world may be deceived."
"Well, Billy Kellett? But he's known to the police!"
"Did I not tell you Davenheim was a clever man? He prepared his alibi long beforehand. He was not in Buenos Aires last autumn. He was creating the character of Billy Kellett, doing 3 months, so that the police should have no suspicions when the time came. He was playing, remember, for a large fortune as well as liberty. It was worthwhile doing the things thoroughly, only..."
"Yes?"
"Eh bien, afterwards he had to wear a false beard and wig, had to make up as himself again, and to sleep with a false beard is not easy. It invites detection. He cannot risk continuing to share the chamber of Madame his wife. Now, you found out for me that for the last 6 months, or ever since his supposed return from Buenos Aires, he and Mrs. Davenheim occupied separate rooms. Then I was sure everything fitted in. The gardener, who fancied he saw his master going round to the side of the house, was quite right. He went to the boathouse, donned his tramp clothes, which you may be sure had been safely hidden from the eyes of his valet, dropped the others in the lake, and proceeded to carry out his plan by pawning the ring in an obvious manner, and then assaulting a policeman, getting himself safely into the haven of Bow Street, where nobody would ever dream of looking for him."
"It's impossible," murmured Jack.